Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Iron Crown by M.A. Grant. Narrated by John Solo. Prologue. Lou.
I've been sitting in this small chamber for hours. The fire crackling in the grate is one of the few luxuries offered me while I wait for Thane Svind, the leader of the Slowa, to decide my future. The rest of the room is bare, proof that the Slowa have never fully recovered from the Fairy Civil War. The plain fabrics and furs here are all created or traded locally in the wilds. Without recognition from the courts, the Slowa will continue to struggle. No other pantheons will trade with them, or recognize their legitimacy. They're limited to their own ingenuity, hard work, and the rare interactions with humans, which carry a multitude of dangers. This room reads as a dark history of Faerie, one pushed back into the shadows by both the summer and winter courts, one artfully ignored by my mother, Queen Mab. Unlike this austere place, the winter court she is filled with decorative touches, each one purchased at a bloody cost. Mother has spent her immortality carving a legacy into the stone and ice of her kingdom. Recitations of her exploits have spread across pantheons and into the consciousness of humanity itself. She is a force of nature, a legend. I'll never measure up to her. I have no desire to. Everyone forgets that legends grow in the rich earth where bodies have been buried deep. After all, the voices of the dead have fallen silent, and no one is left to speak for them. No one but me. Lou. I glance to my right and find Kieran leaning in through the doorway leading back into the main room of the great hall. The fire and lamplight make shadows dance over his serious expression, and nothing can hide his growing tension. After a century spent training and traveling together, I can read my best friend with the same ease I read the stars. Did the Thane ask for me? Kieran's brow furrows, the lines settling deeper, and he takes a slow inhalation before saying, "We can still leave. He would let us go." He's right. Thane Svind hasn't hidden how little he wants us here in his village's great hall. He had no idea who we were, or my position as a prince of the Winter Court, when we rescued him from a boar hunt gone awry late last night. With our dirty clothes and well-behaved mounts, he assumed we were slower passing between villages, and invited us back to Iyar as thanks for our assistance. The truth came out when we ate a private dinner with him while the villagers slept. Learning the youngest son of Queen Mab was eating at his table brought a hard glint to Svin's eyes, then made Kieran check his weapons subtly for the rest of dinner. The Thane has every reason to wish us ill. As a child, he watched Mother's ascension to power in the Winter Court come at a brutal cost. He was a rare survivor, considering most in the slower villages she passed through on her way north were slaughtered by the Seelie chasing after her. Later, he fought to defend his village in the wilds when the first Fairy Civil War slipped past the court's lands. Centuries of his life have been steeped in blood spilled directly, or indirectly, by Mother's hand. Nothing I could do could ever make up for the pain my family has caused Svend or his people, though I intend to try. It's why I accepted his offer, and why it's time for me to rise now. I abandon the chair I've been sitting in as I await the Thane's command, and head toward the door. Kieran doesn't move out of my way. Instead, he plants himself there, an immovable mountain of a man, and stares down at me. "Lou," he says again, "are you sure you want to do this? There's no going back." "I know," I grin, hoping it hides my nervousness, and give him an utterly useless push. "But if I take it, I could finally help." "At what cost?" he asks, his voice as low and gentle as the first few times he asked. "You'll never be able to show your face, your true face, among the Slowa again. Wouldn't that bother you?"
"Why would it? I don't want to be a legend," I reply, shuddering from the memory of sightless faces following me in halls and brushing against me without warning. "Mother's past haunts her still, and I will not create my legacy in her image." "I don't," I repeat, forcing the waver from my voice. "Thane's friend is granting me a position that will give me the freedom to travel the wilds and help anyone I want."
"Thane's friend is offering you a long leash," Kieran argues. "He doesn't expect you to help those in the villages. He expects you to spy for him and bring him news of life in the court. He's going to use you, Lou."
"I won't let that happen. We know why he's doing this, so he won't be able to take advantage of us."
I cross my arms over my chest and glare at him, frustrated he can't understand this.
"Working with him is the best way to prevent further bloodshed. The Slowa have suffered enough at the hands of our courts, and I won't let their neutrality be taken advantage of."
"You won't change my mind on this, Kieran. Either stand beside me, or get out of my way." Kieran's dark gaze meets mine, and holds in a test of my resolve. The sound of feasting from the hall rises and echoes down to us. The entire town has turned out for tonight's festivities, though they have no idea how momentous the occasion truly is. I'm about to order Kieran to move, when he glances away and steps out of the doorway.
"He expects you to wear a hood to hide your face," he warns, jaw tight and voice rough.
I draw my glamour up in the illusion of a shadowed hood and move past Kieran before he can change his mind. He follows behind me, a furious shadow, as I make my way out of the private chambers and into the central meeting space of the hall. The crowd quiets when we appear, and Thane Svend rises from his seat with raised hands. His crown, a simple band of patterned iron, rests over his brow and catches the light, reminding all who look at him who has the weight of the Slower's support and their military might at his back.
"Our guest of honor is here at last," he announces to the curious crowd. His words are practiced, theatrical, and seemingly kind, but the greed in his eyes when he watches me makes the back of my neck prickle. I avoid looking at him directly, and instead focus my attention on the Slower around us. No one in the crowd looks too disturbed to find a hooded figure in their midst. A young boy grips a wooden practice sword in a grubby hand and watches Kieran and me with open fascination.
"Smile," I whisper to Kieran at my side. He grumbles, but must try. The boy's eyes go wide, and his grin grows until we can see all his teeth. At least we have one supporter in this room. The Thane is continued talking, and I briefly regret ignoring him when he grips me at the elbow and raises my arm high toward the roof.
"Without the gods' interference, my life would have drained into the earth of the forest. Without the gods' interference, our people would never have been blessed by the arrival of this stranger, who is destined to lead us to greatness."
He turns and looks over the whole crowd, drawing out the drama of the moment, and finally finishes with,
"My people, it is time to rejoice, for the gods have given us a new satyr."
Murmurs and whispers break out among the villagers. For the Slower, satyrs serve as divine witnesses, the eyes and mouth of the gods, and thanes are considered blessed to be under their private, and often confidential, advisement. It's a title that offers safety and power, but one that also keeps its bearer from becoming too familiar with the observed. The Thane warned me earlier that there would likely be negative reactions to his announcement. After all, in slower history, the only times Seda have risen are during periods of war or upheaval. The last rose during Mother's war against the Seelie, in those bloodiest years when she established the might of the Winter Court, and the violence spilled into the wilds in the process. The older Slower here will remember that, and see my presence as a portent of struggles to come. The title I'm about to accept is still steeped in the blood of the war my mother waged to secure her power. Even if it takes the rest of my life, I will secure peace and wash those stains clean. As we suspected, a man stands in the back of the hall and asks,
"Why have the gods sent him to us now?"
Voices rise in support of his question. Another man stands and points at me.
"What miracles has he performed to grant him such a title?"
His tone is accusatory enough that Kieran steps forward a bit, preparing to shield me if needed. Thanesfind pauses, surprised at the question, and offers back,
"He saw my coming death and saved me."
A tisk from one of the women at a nearby table.
"I saved others' lives, and the gods didn't see fit to grant me any titles."
A few chuckles ripple through the room, though most of the villagers look concerned or frightened. The air is tensing, changing around us, and I worry Thanesfind hasn't prepared himself for the possibility of true rejection. This role isn't one he can simply assign. There must be proof from the gods to convince the people it's necessary, and, no matter my best efforts, unless I receive their support, I will never truly take on the position.
"Tell us," a new voice calls out. "Tell us what he's done."
The sentiment is echoed again and again, until the demand grows in volume and speed. What answer could they possibly want? I can't tell them the truth. I can't even tell Kieran the truth, and he deserves to know more than anyone. There's no way to give them what they want. And perhaps that's what their Thane has hoped for all along. A way to deny me a place here, to force me to flee from a dangerous situation without lifting a finger on his own. The moment my failure seems imminent, Kieran steps forward. He lifts his chin and stares down the crowd. Only when they quiet completely does he rumble. "So, you question why the gods would send this stranger into your midst. You question whether he will be able to serve you in your times of need. I stand before you now, a witness to the glorious battles he has fought. This man, this brave satyr, abandoned his home as a child, determined to change his fate and honor the gods' will. They lead him with noble visions, and he obeys their commands. To please them, he has hunted monsters through the wilds and proved his worth." My glamour grants me the safety I need to gape at Kieran as he weaves me a legend from the air itself. His deep voice twists and falls around the phrases, coaxing every listener to lean in closer, to share in his familiarity with me. And even I begin to believe him, though I know he's transforming our childhood adventures into something bigger, something brighter than I ever imagined. The Thane listens with rapt attention, though the tightness of his mouth warns he's beginning to realize how deeply he underestimated Kieran, who continues to speak with growing passion. "When the moon hung above last night, the gods brought the satyr to your beloved lord. They gave him strength of hand to heft his spear and gut the boar before it savaged its prey. So your satyr slaughtered the gruesome creature and offered his services to your Thane. Would you deny him this privilege?
Would you ask him to ignore your plight when he can foresee the court's greed? The gods blessed your thane with the wisdom to accept their servant. What of you?
A deathly hush blankets the whole. I squirm under my illusory disguise, but Kieran doesn't move, doesn't budge. He stands before the slower and awaits their answer. It comes in a shattering call of approval. Their eager support shakes up through the rafters, and my fears melt away. Some of the slower begin chanting, "Poet, poet," at Kieran, who flushes at the proffered title. Thane's Finn smiles and nods as though he agrees with Kieran's sudden fame and my unexpected approval. When the crowd continues to chant on, he gives up waiting and turns to us. Only now, with his back to his subjects, does his smile slip away, replaced with a bitter glare he fixes on me. "You will not bear our helm," he whispers. "You may have the title, but you are not one of us, and you will not forget that truth." It's a vicious strike, one meant to punish me and Kieran for our success. Denying me the helm the previous Seder War means I will never be allowed to forget how different I am from them, how I am an outsider who doesn't fit into their world. Without a physical helm, I will have to use my glamour to hide my face. Every day will remind me that I am an interloper, who is not truly welcome in the lands I've grown to love so deeply. The Thane's smile is cruel, and vanishes the moment he spins back to the crowd and raises his hands. I have no opportunity to argue with him. I will have to make a choice here and now. The hall falls into an expectant hush.
"I have found you a Seder to protect us in the coming years," he tells them. "Do you approve this choice?"
A short, sharp cry of affirmation.
"He shall ride through our lands. He shall be our horned king, and all who see him shall know he bears the God's blessing."
Another agreement.
"So we accept the God's will and honor their chosen one."
The slower in the hall all bow their heads toward me. My mouth is dry, my palms clammy, and I don't know what to do. I don't know, so I turn to Kieran and find him on his knee beside me, though he does not bow his head. Instead, he holds my gaze and reminds me, in a whisper,
"You are their Seder, and I'm your poet. Prove it to them now."
Bolstered by his support, I take a deep breath and face the crowd. They think the gods speak to me. They trust me to keep them safe from the courts. At least I can manage the second. None of them are watching me now. They don't know Svend denied me their physical helm. No one would question if it were to appear on my head while their heads were bowed. They would assume Svend had given me the helm. It would be part of the ritual and left at that. I reach deep into my glamour's well of magic and craft a rack of antlers tall and wide, whose spikes point up toward the heavens in supplication, and whose bone will glow warmly in the firelight. They extend beyond my hood, so visible no one will be able to deny my role in the wilds. I will not be the spare, unseelie prince hiding in the shadows of his cloak, easily discarded by Svend when he thinks his people have forgotten me. I will be the horned king, and I will serve the slower with all my power and heart. The young boy with the wooden sword is the first to lift his head and risk a glance at me. At the sight of my new helm, he makes a soft sound of amazement, as if I've knocked the air from him, and the slower around him look up, noticing the visual proof of my position for the first time. It's a heavy helm to bear,
especially since my magic isn't as strong as my brother's or mother's. But its weight, and the focus required to maintain it, is nothing compared to the reverence in their whispered prayers of thanks to the gods. I close my eyes and let those voices echo through me. The Horned King rides. Gods bless us. The Horned King rides.
Chapter 1. 7 centuries later. Kieran.
I hate this,
Lou mutters again, forcefully pushing a whippy branch out of his horse, Leah's path. I reach forward and brace for the sting that inevitably comes when Lou releases the branch without warning. It slaps into my palm, and I growl against the heated line. Still, better to be hit in the hand than in the face, or for the branch to hit my poor mount, Dub, who's flighty enough from Leah's ill temper, which mirrors his master's far too well.
This is all Slonje's fault,
Lou continues to grumble.
Such a hypocrite. Spends centuries lecturing me on duty and honor and assorted fuckery, and he goes off and defects with the Seelie's high fucking princess. Now mother's obsessed even more with the triumvirate, and you know she's going to sit me down and have the talk with me again, and...
I ignore most of Lou's complaints. He's been reciting them for days now, since we received Queen Mab's royal decree to return to the Winter Court. Lou's always had a habit of veering off course to complete odd quests, or uncannily finding people in need, which prevents us from getting anywhere in a clean line. And while I admire his dedication to helping the Slowa villagers who live in the borderlands of the court's territories, showing defiance for the Queen's commands by arriving later than expected is a dangerous game to play. The world is becoming more complicated. Lou's existence alone used to be enough. He was the third son, necessary to balance the triumvirate's power in a sustainable way, but never due to inherit anything. Most of the court's magic was balanced between Queen Mab, by Prince Slonje, and Prince Lean. Lou's magic has never been as stable or as powerful as theirs, and he struggles to draw on it for anything more than the glamour he uses to create his helm. In a way, his ineptitude is the only reason he's enjoyed such freedom. But after his eldest brother's defection to the summer court months ago, Queen Mab's patience for Lou's antics and wild ways has lessened, and his magical responsibilities have grown. The message she sent a few days ago by Raven was a brutal reminder of how swiftly circumstances could change. A Seelie attack against Prince Lean while he was on the grounds of Mather's School of Magic, a neutral territory for all pantheons, means the rumors we've been hearing through the wilds may be true. A second civil war is coming, and Queen Mab is moving her pieces into position while she can. The risk of losing Lou so soon after his eldest brother's defection is unacceptable to her. She will corral Lou and the Unseelie Shi in a heartbeat if she thinks it would keep him safe and stabilize her court. She will take the experienced soldiers who ride in his hunt, Sybil, dressed in Armel, from him. She will take me from him. Try to, at least. Lou knows this, and has no intention of bringing her wrath down on our heads. He promised to return to the Shi. He just avoided specifying when. Now, less than a day's ride from our destination, and incapable of putting off our return any longer, it takes every ounce of my willpower to not push Lou out of his saddle and leave him for some creature to eat. He's been stuck in his head since we camped near a stone circle a few days ago. It was a bad night, one full of an unending line of nightmares. Since then, he hasn't slept, which means I haven't slept, and he won't talk to me about what's bothering him. Instead, he snarls his displeasure under his breath as we duck branches and give our horses their heads through the worsening undergrowth. The other men in the hunt have given Lou and me greater and greater distance as the days progress. They withdraw from us, with the same deliberate silence they direct toward lovers' quarrels observed in Sloa halls. They know their limitations, and when Lou enters one of his dark moods, it's wisest to abandon care of him to me. Our centuries-long friendship means I know all his tells, and how far he can be pushed. We've fallen into something akin to marriage, with good-natured bickering and affectionate patience aplenty, though at this moment even my patience is running thin.
I swear to the goddess, if Mother thinks she can force me to stay for all the Samhain festivities, she's going to be sorely disappointed,
Lou declares. It's a hollow challenge, one I know he'll fail at when he's forced to face Queen Mab in person. I don't mention that, though, unwilling to provide fuel for Lou's rant. Dorb's ears prick forward. Ahead of us, Leith's slowed, his head turning to take in something slightly off to our left. Lou continues to ramble, but I ignore him and try to see what's caught the horse's attention. Ahead of us, on the edge of a small clearing, I catch a flash of movement. Lou, I murmur.
No, he snaps back at me. I'm not done yet.
Dub starts forward when I press my heels into his flank. We catch up to Leith, and I reach over to take hold of the reins. Lou swears when the horses come to a sudden jolting halt and turns to glare at me.
Kieran, what's gotten into you?
I point and whisper. There's someone up ahead. Like that, his ill humor vanishes. He leans forward in the saddle, already reaching for his hunting spear.
You take left?
He asks. A question, not a command. He didn't see what I did, so he's trusting me to make the call. By now, the men have caught up to us. Dressed already has an arrow knocked, while Sybil and Armel have their spears at the ready. I don't take my eyes from the clearing ahead, still waiting for another sign of motion. Sybil and Armel will go left. We'll go right. Dressed, cover us. I saw something.
Quiet or fast?
Armel asks, already turning his horse in preparation. I risk a glance at Lou. He's vibrating out of his skin, eager to charge ahead. Best to use that to our advantage. Fast, I say. I forego my father's double-handed iron axe on my back, and instead draw one of the short axes hanging from my belt. Lou notices and grins at me, all feral teeth and open challenge. He tilts his head toward the clearing. I nod, and he looses a wild whoop before charging ahead, the rest of us behind him. We crash into the clearing and fan out, but it's easy enough to see there's only one creature there, one unfit for hunting. It's nothing more than a scrawny, sickly-looking fairy who trips and falls over himself in an effort to escape us. It's a hopeless endeavor. Sybil's already cut him off on the left, and Lou lets Dub and I surge forward to cut off his escape on the right. When the fairy realizes the game's lost, he collapses to the ground, cowering and covering the back of his neck with clasped hands.
Will?
Lou calls to me as he rides closer. The fairy lifts his head and meets my gaze, only to whimper and hide his face again. It's too late to avoid recognition. I know what he is.
Yusufar, I spit out.
A fucking Seely. Worse, a Seely close to the unseely she, who's somehow gotten this far undetected.
A danger to the Winter Court and all who reside there. A danger to Lou. I can't allow that.
Let's kill him and get home.
Sybil and Armel grunt in approval. Dressed, who's hanging back, nods. We've always understood each other, especially when it comes to ensuring Lou's safety. All unseely military retirees, they accepted Queen Mab's offer to act as tutors and personal guards to Lou and me. Their service under the Queen in the First Fairy Civil War means they know the dangers posed by the Summer Court and its inhabitants. And even Dressed, the easiest going of the group, has an arrow trained on the cowering fairy. If I aim for the Seely's neck, I should be able to put him out of his misery quickly enough.
Wait!
Lou commands, his head tilting to the side as he inspects the fairy. I glance at him, shocked at the showing of his mercy. What? Hear me out, he urges.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?